This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. There is increasing pressure to get school children to engage with science, technology, engineering, and math. STEM, for short. So someone wondered if it might be possible to make these subjects entertaining. Later in the program, we'll meet some folks trying to do just that and hear about the fruits of their labor, a Broadway-bound stage show called Fun with STEM. First, though, something completely different. They say a picture is worth a thousand words, and in today's world, we've come to depend on pictures to take us to places, to help us understand unfolding news events, and to give us insight into different cultures and the challenges faced by people in other parts of the world, all in ways that words just cannot. Getting those pictures is the job of photojournalists, many of them women, who willingly take themselves to unstable, uncertain, even dangerous parts of the world. Their work is invaluable, but rarely do we consider the danger and discomfort these people experience in the course of doing their jobs. National Geographic, however, is celebrating some of the women who do this work in a new exhibition that will open at the Mint Museum uptown. Women of Vision makes the first stop of its national tour at the Mint beginning Saturday and running through July 20th. And joining us to talk about it is one of the photojournalists included in the exhibit and a woman who is best known for her photo essays in National Geographic as well as her documentation of conditions in Haiti, where she has worked for 30 years. Maggie Stieber is a photographer, a former photo editor for, I think, the Associated Press and the Miami Herald, and an educator whose work has been exhibited from Paris to China. What a pleasure it is to have you with us this morning. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you so much. We're so happy to be here.
And she is obviously in our Spirit Square studio, along with Elizabeth Christ, who is National Geographic Magazine's senior photo editor and curator of the Women of Vision exhibit, which opens on Saturday. Good morning. Welcome to you.
Good morning.
Nice to have you here as well. On the jacket flap to the companion book, which is just fabulous. It's a wonderful book. And I'm assuming it's the companion for this exhibit.
Yes.
It says that some of the most powerful narratives of the past decade have been produced by a forward-thinking generation of women photojournalists. Why is that? Why women?
I have to say at the outset that I don't make a distinction between photographs that were shot by men or shot by women, but I do think it's really important to have a lot of women photographers shooting because they tend to address the issues that are more important to women and they have better access to them. Issues like maternal mortality or sexual assault or child marriage. And I think that that's why we want to see a lot more women shooting.
Well, I was going to ask you, is the work of women, and because you work with males and females at the
right.
At National Geographic. Is it different? Is it substantially different? Or is the point of view different? And I mean that with the pun intended, because they're looking through a lens.
Right. I honestly don't feel that there is in my own mind. I think that gender is just one of many factors, but I think it does play into it the same way, you know, your cultural upbringing or your any kind of economic background or your age or your height even, you know, might play into the way that you see the world and the way that the world sees you. So I do think that makes a difference.
So why then this exhibit, which started in Washington at the National Geographic, Women of Vision, has there been a Men of Vision exhibit?
No, there hasn't been, and I would love to see the day when that would be necessary, but at the moment I don't think that it is.
And we'll talk, we're going to talk about that too. Let's talk about that now, because National Geographic started out essentially a men's magazine. It was about men who were then in 1888 exploring the world. It was exclusively almost the purview of men. And I'm assuming that when the magazine added photographs, the photographs were being taken by either the explorers themselves or other men who accompanied those people. When did women start becoming the photojournalists in the magazine?
Well, what's really fascinating is it's true that the first few years that we published, we had no photographs in the magazine. But in 1905, there was a whole series of photos done on Lhasa. And that was the first real essay that appeared in the magazine. But I have to tell you that there were photographs that appeared before then. And we think that the first images by women were actually shot by Eliza Skidmore in 1899
wow.
on the Stikine River. But they weren't credited. it, but she wrote the article, and we're pretty sure she shot the pictures,
because
too.
Because this was considered to be an unsuitable profession for
That's
women.
Right.
Why?
That's right. Because women were supposed to be in the home, and they weren't supposed to be out venturing into these dangerous places. But that's the other reason I love this exhibition, is because you see women in very dangerous places. You know, they're in conflict zones. They're shooting in sub-zero temperatures. They're in the middle of epidemics, and they're doing, you know, illegal slavery sites undercover. And so I think that's pretty inspirational for the next generation of girls to see, you know, that women can do all these things.
These are some of the situations that you have placed yourself in, Maggie Stieber, over the years. You've taken, if not dangerous, and although some of the places you have gone were in fact dangerous, your life was threatened and your car was burned, etc. But it's certainly uncomfortable. Haiti, 30 years in Haiti has not been, you didn't go and stay at the Ritz, I'm sure, so it was not comfortable. Why do you do these things?
Well, I'm very curious about the world, and I have to credit my mother. My mother and father were divorced when I was a little baby, and my mother raised me, and she was a very strong woman, and she always encouraged me to go out, be very independent, go out, see the world, you know, and so I have to credit her with that, first of all. But I am very curious about the world. I mean, it's a big place. Lots of things happen. I think that a lot of things happen to women, and it's really important to be able to try to use photography to bring things to the fore for people to be informed about things. I think pictures do that in a way that, as much as I love words, and I do, I love writing, I love words, but photographs do it in one look, you know?
And they're universal. You don't have to speak French or Pashto. You get it.
It's a universal language. Everybody gets it. And photographs have a real psychological effect on people as well. So I just find it fascinating. I feel like I remember when I was a student learning photography, and a friend of mine drew a little picture of me, a little caricature, and it was a picture of me with my mouth just dropped open, wide-eyed and dropped open in awe. And I think that's really why I do it. I'm completely in awe of the world.
Are you in awe while you're taking the pictures, or are you more in awe when the pictures, of course, this is old-fashioned, I'm going to say when the pictures have been developed. I'm sure you just have to push a button now, and there they are in the viewfinder. But are you more in awe when you see what you've shot?
I'm more in awe of the moment that I'm photographing. Because photographs are evidence of something that happened. And a lot of it's luck. You're lucky to be in a certain place. You're lucky to be there at a certain moment, that sort of thing. So I'm very in awe of being there in the moment and seeing those things and being able to capture them. But then sometimes I'm also in awe of, you know, the finished product. But I have to say this, is that at the end of one's life, or even at the end of the day after shooting, you realize that what we do is a very privileged thing, because people let us come into their lives, or we get to poke our nose into business of other people, other countries. It's not something everybody can do, whether you're a man or a woman. In a lot of cultures, women would never be able to do this. So I'm rather in awe of that, but I love the idea that we create these historic documents. And to me, that is the most exciting thing about it. And that when I'm a very old dame, I'm going to be sitting in my rocking chair, and I'm going to remember the experiences.
Yeah.
It really gives you a life of experiences one never expected to have, really.
I'd like to hear from both of you on this, because you are a photo editor at National Geographic, and every medium, be it print, television, radio, seems to be expanding into multi-platforms. Nobody is a radio station anymore. We have Twitter feeds, and we have video on Facebook and on the web. You do too, I'm sure. So a photograph is a moment in time. It's that, and it's done. I mean, it's frozen forever. Video goes on and on and on. Talk to me about the value of and the function of a photograph in the 21st century.
I have a little story about that.
Okay.
There's a very famous photograph by a man named Eddie Adams. He was a very famous photographer, and he covered the war in Vietnam. And there's a very famous picture where a general, a South Vietnamese general, is shooting a Viet Cong suspect mm-hmm. in the head. Mm-hmm. Everybody's seen this photograph. It's very violent. It's very disturbing. I also saw the video that was shot by an Australian cameraman. You don't even see it happen. It's so fast. That man is shot. It's so fast, if you blink, you don't miss it. You miss it
uh-huh.
in the video. But that photograph is there. And all of the violence, all of the history, all of the rights or wrongs or the machinations of war are in that photograph. And you can't get away from it. You can't look away from it. And the video is just very different. It's nothing like the photograph. And I think that's what, you know, there's this saying, be still, my beating heart. And that's what a photograph is sort of like. You know, it does capture a moment. It's amazing. And I love that, especially now in the world, everything is moving so fast. You just, you know, your head is spinning with how quickly we're moving in our lives, in the world, how everything is happening. And here's this thing, this marvelous thing that just makes you stop, and it's frozen, this frozen moment. I think it's thrilling.
And it would seem to me that that very idea, that this crystallizes a moment and it freezes, it makes you stop and see something for what it truly is. You have to be very careful that that is what it truly is.
I think that's right. It has to absolutely represent, you know, what you think the meaning was of that moment. I think it's true. And I don't even know if it's the capacity of the brain, but you feel as if people's memories are so often those still moments. You know, it's what we grasp and what we remember out of our history.
Does that make your job harder? The fact that there's it seems to me a responsibility to pick the right photo.
It is, but it's such a joy because we're often editing 30,000, 50,000, even 100,000 images for one story. And we're combing through all of that. And when you see that one moment, it is just the most profound feeling.
How difficult is that? I can't imagine. 100,000 pictures for a story. And in a story, what's the average picture count in a story in National
Geographic? It could be anything from, 12 to 22 or something.
Okay, out of 100,000.
Right, it's true.
How do you know you've made the right decision? How do you have time to go through 100,000
pictures? It's time-consuming, and it is so difficult. But the key is that every photograph I'm looking for that's going to earn its space in a layout has to have a combination of being something that is really revealing and surprising and that tells you something you didn't know about the subject, but also converges with that sense of having some kind of really memorable, graphic, striking visual quality.
You have been a photo editor several times in your career. You are a photo editor right now, Elizabeth.
Mm-hmm.
What qualifications do you bring to that job? How do you get to be a photo editor?
That's a tough question. Do you want to answer?
Well, I think, first of all, you have to really love looking at photographs. Mm-hmm. If you're not interested and you don't have the time or the discipline.
The passion.
And the passion. Mm-hmm. Then you should not be a photo editor.
Right.
Because you really do look at a lot of things. But I would say that the thing that made me interested in being a photo editor were two things. And one was studying the history of photography. I was completely amazed. If you study from the very moment when Niepce created the first photograph until now, the history of photography is so amazing. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that I was going to say is something I just forgot. So,
well, think about it, because we're going to take a break. And if you remember it in the break, we will come back and get to that. And then we're going to talk about this exhibit, Women of Vision, which opens Saturday at the Mint, and it will be in existence there till July 20th. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members at Duke University's Master of Management in Clinical Informatics program, a one-year master's program offered on weekends for working professionals, accepting applications for August class start, dukemmci.org. And exceptional artists presenting comedian and frequent This American Life commentator Mike Birbiglia at the Knight Theater on Saturday, March 29th. Tickets at carolinatix.org. 1.8 million people are served by North Carolina's Medicaid program, but Governor McCrory has called it broken and inefficient, and an audit discovered that the state did not, in fact, manage costs very well, and in fact, has overpaid medical providers. So the governor has a new proposal on how to operate the system that it would involve giving more control to medical providers and to hospitals and hold them accountable. We'll talk about what it might mean for taxpayers, for patients, and for providers tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, former President Jimmy Carter believes discrimination against women is the world's most serious unaddressed challenge. His thoughts on improving women's lives and other critical issues of today.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE. Charlotte's NPR News source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about Women of Vision, an exhibit of photographs from National Geographic, which opened at National Geographic, but now has come to Charlotte and the Mint Museum uptown. It opens on Saturday, runs through July 20th. Maggie Stieber is a photojournalist who has worked on and off for many publications, but for the National Geographic, some of her work is in the exhibit. And Elizabeth Christ is the photo editor and curator of this, photo editor for the magazine and the curator of the exhibit from National Geographic. You were in the middle of a thought about being a photo editor. You forgot what you were going to say, but now you have remembered. So, Maggie, go ahead and finish up.
Yes, I did remember, and here's what it is. If you think about how there's just this little frame and how many people are looking through it, and yet everybody sees something different. If you send 100 photographers to photograph one thing, every one of them is going to see it differently and take a different kind of picture. And to me, that is the most fascinating thing. I just never tire of it. I'm completely mesmerized by the idea, and I love it. I love it. I love it so much. I could have been a picture editor all my life.
So how do you know? So how do you know it's the right picture? How do you know that you have chosen the one that really represents the moment if everybody sees it slightly differently? And that's how we see the world. Everybody's experience of the world is different. That's true. But you're looking for truth.
Well, you can look at 100 images in a row, and the one that speaks to you, I mean, there might be several that speak to you, but there's you can always look at them over and over until you find a reason why there's that one.
You know, I'm going to interrupt for a minute.
Photography
is a language. And if you speak the language, if you look at photographs long enough, which we've both done, photographs speak to you, and they tell you which one is the right one. It sounds mystical and kind of like, oh, they're nuts. But it's really the truth, don't you think?
It is.
They speak to you. They yell out, and they say, I'm the one, Elizabeth.
Because that's the amazing thing is when you edit with a photographer, the two of you could each do your separate edit, and there will always be those, you know, several images that you both are passionate about that you agree on. I mean, there's just that convergence, and it's wonderful.
Women of Vision, as I said, started, it's the work of 11 women who have shot pictures that have appeared in the pages of the National Geographic. I want to talk about how you got to that 11, because if you have 100,000 pictures that you go through for every story, how many women photographers have there been? But you're starting off your national tour of this exhibit in Charlotte. Why us?
Well, I have to say that we are incredibly grateful to PNC Bank, which is our national tour sponsor, and they've been kind enough to talk about bringing the exhibition to five or six different markets across the United States. And we're especially grateful to Weston Andrus, who's the regional PNC president who is on the board of the Mint Museum. And he's one of the people who really made it happen.
And it's here for a long time. I mean, it's here till July 20th. That's wonderful.
Yes, it's fantastic.
Now, let's talk about how you got to 11 photographers.
Sure.
How many women have shot photographs for National Geographic over the years? Do you know?
I couldn't even tell you, but I will tell you that, you know, the first woman photographer who came on staff at the Geographic was in 1953. But as I mentioned with Eliza Skidmore, they've been shooting for the magazine since probably at least 1899. And so there have been a lot of women. But what we did was because there was a previous book that came out in 2000 that outlined the entire history of women photographers at National Geographic, what we did was Catherine Kane had the idea of wanting to do this exhibition because since then, there have been so many powerful stories by women. So this is our attempt to update that show and that book and to talk about the current generation.
How did you choose the 11 women?
You know, I looked at the women who were most actively shooting for us over the last decade to 12 years. And there were really 10 to 12 women that we felt most strongly about. And we just looked at it, and it was really an organic number. 11 was really the right number.
Okay. And of the 11 women, and I'm looking at the companion book here, I'm sure that there are more photographs from to represent the work of these
women. Oh, absolutely.
Than there are in the book. But how did you choose the photographs? That's another process.
Absolutely. And I have to say, I'm just tremendously grateful to all of my colleagues, the other photo editors on staff, because, you know, each of them edited all of these stories. And I worked on some of these stories, but, you know, it's building upon the work of all of those editors who went through those, you know, 30,000 to 50,000 images for each story. And we looked at all of the pictures that they chose and showed to the editors. But then some of the photographers came to me and said, you know, here's a secret favorite of mine that I never got to put into the final show.
I was going to ask if, as a photographer, you look at the exhibit and you think, gee, I wish this other picture were here, or that you had a chance to talk to Elizabeth to say,
this
is the one that ought to be in here.
No, we did quite a bit. Elizabeth is great about really involving all of us in the selection.
And we collaborated.
Yes, it was a very sweet collaboration, actually.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Is there a theme that runs through the work of these photographers or through the exhibit itself?
You know, my feeling was more about trying to bring out the unique sensibility of each photographer. I just felt that I wanted to somehow get at the essence of how they see. And so for me, it was much more about, you know, targeting the work of each person rather than looking at an overall unification of the
show. The other thing, it seems to me, is the way that these photographs will be presented in the exhibit.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many ways, different sizes, different methods of reproducing the photographs, whether they're matte or glossy or whatever. Mm-hmm. Who did that?
You know, we worked really closely with Alan Parente, who was a designer of the exhibition at National Geographic in Washington. Mm-hmm. And he really came up with a whole theme of, you know, sort of the pacing of the exhibition and the order of the exhibition. And they came up with some fantastic ideas about showing how the editing process works, which you'll see, and there's some videos. But the only thing I asked of Alan is that because National Geographic is so much about narrative and storytelling, that if there were several photographs from one story, that he try to group them together. Yeah. But otherwise, he was really responsible.
National Geographic. I got my first subscription to National Geographic as a birthday present when I was 11 years old.
I'd love to hear that.
I used to read it cover to cover, but I would go through first and look at all the pictures.
Mm-hmm.
Then I would go back and read the articles. So it seems to me that if you're a photographer, National Geographic is the holy grail of printed photography. Am I wrong?
I think you're right. And every time I teach any workshops or teach students, everybody to an individual says, oh, my dream is to work for National Geographic. And then I set in telling them, oh, because they always say, oh, because I love to travel. And I say, well, that's the last thing you should ever say if you go to the Geographic, because even though you travel, but that's the easiest part, because there's so much research put in, there's so much effort. I mean, you have many, as a photographer, you can have many sleepless nights, I think as a photo editor too, worrying about whether something is going to work out. People will keep you waiting for 3 months to finally say yes or no to a request.
And there's so many hardships. You know, people don't realize,
so
you know, the months away from your family and the illnesses and the really tough working conditions. And I think people don't, you know, take that into account when they think of the romance of being a National Geographic.
When you stress from the outside, but it's just
it is tough.
Plain hard work.
When you shoot for National – when you go on a story – for National Geographic. Do you enterprise that story? Do you come to them and say, I really think we ought to do this story and I need to go here to get these pictures? Or do they come to you and say, we have this story we want to do and you're the photographer we want to use? How does it work?
It happens both ways. You can propose something. Mm-hmm. It should be well-researched. It's not just sort of a, oh, I want to photograph beauty. You know, you have to really talk about, well, you know, you have to do research, you have to write a proposal, you have to have some ideas about what the pictures would show, but it works both ways. So sometimes the Geographic comes to you and says, we think you're the photographer to do this, and then you work with the picture editor. You're nothing without the picture editor. Nothing happens without the picture
editor. It is like
these
a marriage.
The most, they're the unsung heroes, actually, and always with photography, in my opinion.
We talked about some of the places that these photographers have to go and the conditions that they have to endure to do what they have to do to get the story, to get the photographs back to the Geographic or even a newspaper or the Associated Press, whoever you're working for, it's the same job. There may be different parameters, but it's the same job. You started going to Haiti 30 years ago. Why did you start going, and what keeps you going back?
I lived in Africa for 2 years covering a war. And I really loved Africa. It was the war in Rhodesia, which is now Zimbabwe. And when I went back to New York, where I lived at that time, I really missed Africa. There's something about Africa. I would say when your feet are on the ground in Africa, there's this sort of silent thunder that rises up through your body. And you just feel like you belong there, or that's how I felt. And so I missed it, and I was working for a French picture agency, and they said, well, Maggie, why don't you go to Haiti? Because it's just like Africa, and it's much closer. And I went, and in fact, it was very African. And the reason for that is that Haiti was a country that had the only successful slave revolt in the history of the world. Only one.
And they're still being punished for it.
Still being punished for it in many ways that are extraordinary. Mm. And so because of that, the world turned its back on Haiti and isolated it because they didn't want the word to get out that slaves could revolt and succeed. And so that helped it retain some of its Africanness. And Haiti is really the daughter of France and Africa in so many ways. And so it is very African. Even now, it's very African. Many of the traditions, many of the aspects of culture, but it's also a very sophisticated, advanced people. People don't realize there was a very beautiful, healthy, intellectual class and intellectual period in Haiti. Plays were written, paintings were done, but the Duvalier regime, which was a very brutal regime for 30 years, really killed a lot of those people. A lot of people fled Haiti, and Haiti suffered in its ability to move forward because of that, because it's the intellectual classes that really move any culture forward. But people would be surprised.
Over the course of 30 years, you say that you have, you know, when we think of Haiti, at least when I think of Haiti because of news, I think of incredible poverty, I think of corruption, I think of destruction because of the earthquake that they are still recovering from, and it seems that all the money that has gone to Haiti and all the relief efforts that have gone to Haiti have fallen into this black hole and nothing ever changes. So we don't see what you see. You see beauty. How do you see beauty in all of that?
Well, you have to spend a lot of time there, and you have to go at times when these tragedies aren't occurring. And where I find the greatest beauty is in the rural areas, in among the peasants. There's great environmental beauty that you never hear about or see because everybody thinks it's completely deforested, which, by the way, the French started that in the 16th century. It's not just the Haitians' fault. But I guess the thing I think is that there's great beauty of character in Haitians. I have to say that any one of us who had to go and live those lives, get up every morning and try to find enough work to feed your family for one day is an extraordinary challenge, and yet they get up and they do it. They're very strong people. I hate the word resilient because it's applied to them all the time, but that's exactly what they are. And yet in the midst of all of this suffering, some of it is self, you know, is brought on by things within the country. And I have to say something a lot of people don't realize is that there's a lot of interference in Haiti by the United States and France in ways that we don't ever hear about. But people get up. They might live in a I'm so sorry. They might live in a shanty, but they'll come out of that shanty every morning with a pressed shirt, trousers. The women look nice as they can afford to, and they have a great pride. They're a very, very proud people, and they're amazing. They're magical. They're beautiful. They're intellectual. They're sardonic. They're funny, and they are. I just never cease to be amazed by
that. How does that inform your work, your shooting of these people?
Well, certainly when there's any
violence.
With
a camera, by the way.
Whenever there's any violence or news going on, of course, one photographs that. But by having spent so much time there, I really want people to see that there is this, you know, there's this yin and yang to everything, and there is great beauty there and great beauty of character and that sort of thing. I wanted to say this one other thing about the earthquake. Mm-hmm. Yes, billions of dollars were pledged, but not everybody who pledged money sent it. And what a lot of people don't understand about NGOs, for example, or aid organizations, is that they go to do work in a country like Haiti. But before any of that work can even start, they have to get an office. They have to hire people. They have to have security. They have to hire cars with drivers. And then they have to have a staff, and they have to house that staff. And a lot of the money that's promised goes to establishing that. Goes to establishing that before any of it gets to the Haitian people. So I would say this. If my whole body was what was promised, one hand is what gets to the Haitian people in the end.
Wow.
Quite often. And yes, there is a lot of corruption, both in the Haitian government, but even within the NGOs. So not to, I mean, we love NGOs. Thank goodness people care enough to go and help people all around the world. But it's not so simple. You know,
yeah.
It's a very complicated system.
I have 2 minutes left. I'm just curious because when people go, people don't understand. People do not understand this about reporters, and photographers are reporters in their own way.
Yes.
When you go to cover a story in a strange land, you're a stranger in a strange land. You know nothing. How do you know where to go, what to do, who to talk to, who to shoot, how to get the story, that what you're shooting is in fact the story? How do you know these things quickly?
Well, one does a lot of research if one is smart. And you look at the history. I mean, even if you have one day before you're sent to someplace you've never been before, you do your research, you read whatever news reports have been issued, you look at the history. I try to look at the culture, you know, quite often the real history of a place is in its literature. You talk to everybody. Maybe people have been there before. And then I find the taxi driver who speaks English and can talk to me about it. You'd be surprised what those taxi drivers can tell you.
What do you hope people take away from this exhibit when they go to the Mint?
I really hope that it inspires the next generation of girls and women to be fearless, even if they don't become National Geographic photographers, you know, just to not feel like there are any boundaries and to be fearless.
Do you worry about the future of National Geographic as a print publication, and does it matter if it just goes to the internet or to some electronic version?
I think it's going to be powerful no matter what medium it's in. I think it's going to be, you know, just boundless in terms of being able to reach people and, you know, being able to move people with stories, whatever the medium is.
That's Elizabeth Crist, who is the photo editor, or a photo editor for the National Geographic, and the curator of Women of Vision. That's an exhibit that's at the Mint Museum through July 20th. It opens on Saturday. And Maggie Stieber, a photojournalist, and who is represented in the exhibition. Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Charlotte Wine and Food Weekend, celebrating their 25th anniversary with tastings, vintner dinners at area restaurants, Big Bottles and Blues, and Gala, April 22nd through 26th. Tickets at charlottewineandfood.org. Former President Jimmy Carter on why he believes bias against women is the world's most serious unaddressed challenge. He describes how social acceptance of violence and selective religious interpretations serve to reinforce discrimination and abuse, and what he believes can be done to right this long-standing run. Former President Carter on the air with Diane Rehm in 20 minutes on the Diane Rehm Show here on WFAE. And when we come back, we'll be having fun with STEM. Stay with us.
This is Melissa Block of NPR News with a special message for our new supporters. Thank you for joining the growing list of listeners who value the kind of programming that only public radio offers. Without you, public radio wouldn't be here. Your commitment will help us stay on the air in the year ahead. Thank you.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Graduating students who are proficient in science, technology, engineering, and math, STEM, is becoming increasingly important in this worldwide economy. American students have been falling behind, so getting them to engage in STEM has become a priority. But how to get them to do that? Well, that is the question. And perhaps the answer may be found on a stage in a show, with ambitious plans to go to Broadway. Fun with STEM, which is about to take the stage in Charlotte, is a collaborative effort of our guests today and Charlotte ragtime pianist Ethan Uslan. Linda Ann Watt is the producer and director of Fun with STEM, which will be in residence at the Booth Playhouse from Friday through April the 6th. Welcome to the program. Good to
Thank
see you.
You. Thank you so much for having us.
You're welcome. Also with us is Corey Ryback, performer and creator of Fun with STEM, and the man who is Corey the Clown of Corey's Learning Center, seen on PBS member stations. You look just like yourself.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you for being here. Nancy Addison is here. She is director of pre-K through 12 STEM education at CMS and a consultant on Fun with STEM. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
STEM. Let's talk about that first. It's an acronym for science, technology, engineering, and math. And I remember it just appeared out of nowhere a couple of years ago, and I kept thinking, what is STEM? What is this new thing, STEM? Where did it come from?
Well, it's been around quite a few years that we're still kind of battling the – some people are thinking it's stem cell research, and no, it's not that. Once again, it is becoming familiar with science, technology, engineering, and math, and how it affects our lifestyles, the jobs that are available, that pretty much – as you go through the day, you've got to think, how much does one of these parts of this acronym affect what I'm doing, my life, my job, all sorts of things. So it is a building momentum program. It was mentioned by the president several years ago in a speech talking about that we need to make sure we are growing our workforce in these areas to build our economy, to be competitive with the world economy as we move more and more towards jobs in these areas.
But all four of these disciplines, science, mm-hmm. technology, engineering, math, they've been around forever.
Oh, yes.
What has combining them into this acronym done, if anything?
To me, I feel that for years in public education, we've taught almost like the theory of science and math, the concepts, the principles, the context, that when science and math come together, the beauty of it is technology and engineering. And that is our lifestyle, whether it's how the cell phone is working, whether I'm getting a signal or not getting a signal, all comes back to that technology and engineering.
Mm. Now, it's been my experience that those people who are involved in creative things like show business are in show business because they cannot do science, technology, engineering, or math.
It is true, but it...
So why did you think that this would be a good fit for you guys?
It's a funny thing. You start out in entertainment because you have a passion for entertaining, but then everything, like you were saying, everything is combined. And you can't do anything in your day without STEM and STEAM, or we call it A-STEM, but that's including the arts, too.
Yes, I've seen STEMA, I've seen A-STEM, and I've seen STEAM. And the A adds the arts to the process.
Absolutely.
And we have this Arts and Science Council, which always seemed kind of odd to me until this very moment, actually. So where did the idea come from to do this?
Well, it's Corey's creation, so I'll let him take it.
Well, in performing, I've been performing for kids since I'm a child. I started making puppets at 8. I was doing the school libraries all over New York by the age of 12 with marionettes and puppets. And so it's sort of been my whole life. And I've been performing for children my whole life. So they're big sponges, and they have the best imaginations. They're just free. Their mind is free. And so the concept here, because I've been performing for children my whole life, is the first 45 minutes of the show is going to be original music, great musicians. Like you mentioned, Ethan is an amazing pianist, a great composer we have in the show, and just a great cast, all local talent. It's all local. It's actually a Charlotte-based show except for the composer. And so what we're going to do is we're actually going to have the kids are going to see all of this fun stuff. Robots are in the show. There's going to be technology that's in front of them, but not – they don't really realize at this point. They've seen the technology, but they don't understand. They're not going to be told like in this educational sort of format, so that they're just having a great time. Mm-hmm. And then after the 45 minutes is over, we're going to explain to them that nothing that they just saw could have happened without STEM. And like, for example, in the show, there's a pulley system is one of the things that's done. And at the end, they realize that, you know, that that's part of engineering. And then we show how the theater, without the pulley systems, the curtains couldn't go up and down. We actually have wireless cameras so we can go backstage and see the guy lift the thing up and down. So when the kids leave the theater, they would have had a great time. In fact, the adults are going to enjoy it too. It's great music, great dance numbers. But they'll have a great time in the show. And then when they're told that none of it could have happened without STEM, mm-hmm. in this fun way, to see how the robots work, to see the motors moving, because we take the robot apart and they actually get to see it on a big screen live in front of them, then they realize that, wow, STEM could be fun and that this is something I can go into. Mm.
But now you, Corey, and you, Linda, both of you have experience in television.
Mm.
So,
yes.
Since television reaches so many more people than theater, why make this a live show? Why not just make it into a TV show?
Well, we were on the air with Corey's Learning Corner, and it was on 260 PBS stations nationwide, and it was educational with Corey the Clown and celebrity guests, and we had all sorts of humanitarian themes and a lot of education that was fun. But Corey wanted to do, because his passion and his beginnings, it was stage. So he came up with this idea to do this show. And he happened to be talking to Linda Beck, who is with United Way. She's Ralph Beck's wife. He's the educational director of the Blumenthal. And she heard what Corey's concept was, and she said, you know, Corey, that's STEM. And that's how it started. So,
of course, it's not STEM until the school system says it's STEM.
Well, you know, I have to tell you, I went to CMS and I asked, and Nancy was wonderful and so giving, and Wayne Fisher, and now we have Kate Martin that has written the learning segments. We have the Art Institute of Charlotte that got involved to do the website design, mm-hmm. and we have learning segments for teachers and parents, and we have interactive games that Professor Ross did at the Art Institute of Charlotte. And
NewTek is actually a company that gave us this machine where we're actually going to be able to do special effects on the stage. It's called a TriCaster, so that a lot of companies got involved. So it's really technically going to be a lot of
You're
fun.
You're actually doing a green screen thing, right, which is like how they do the weather on television, where the guy stands in front of this wall that's green, but the weather maps is what you see behind him. He doesn't see them. They're not really there.
Right.
But you're doing a thing like that with a train.
With a train, yeah. Well, we have an interactive thing with the audience where there's going to be a toy train on the stage, and the louder they clap or scream, is the faster the train's going to go. And while that's happening, right in front of them, there's going to be a green screen. And I'm going to be standing in front of the green screen, and they're going to see me in real time on this little train, you know, on the big screen projected. And so the louder they clap, so they're controlling the train, but they're actually seeing me on the train at the same time. Mm-hmm. And then at the end, we're going to show how that's actually the TriCaster from NewTek is actually giving us that capability. And
don't stop talking.
Oh, okay.
Just because I have to breathe every once in a while.
I guess I do too. So anyway, so they get to see that live, and then at the end they learn that the computer was able to get rid of the green and uh-huh. that, how it puts it together. And mm-hmm. so, you know, that's
It's kinesthetic learning, so that the children are really engaged in the show.
Because CMS is involved in this and because you're bringing students to this, you have input and you are the consultant on this from the school system's point of view. What needed to be in this? What did you tell them? This is what you have to have in this to make this compatible not only with what CMS wants, right, but this is compatible with Common Core, I'm told. Mm-hmm.
Actually, over a year ago at a breakfast meeting, Linda and I got talking about this idea, and I thought it was absolutely fabulous. And she has been like a one-woman dynamo with this.
Thank you.
So I said, it's a great idea. We'd love to be a part of it. So as she started to develop the content and to develop the ideas, we took it to our science specialist, and he read over it and said, yes, this is appropriate for the age level. Yes, this does align with the state standards that we do expect the students to know for the science and the math that would correspond with what they might be learning in the classroom. And so she took that and built from that, and it has just been it'll be a fabulous advantage for our students.
I have to salute you, because if I were I would have to kill myself.
Well, you do Charlotte squawks, so you know what I'm doing.
It's a little different. We're not trying to teach anybody anything.
Okay.
So, but there are some things that you have to work into this, and some of these things I'm sure you weren't familiar with.
No, absolutely. It was a learning curve. Basically, what it was trying to do was take everything that Corey's creativity has brought forward and then just pare it down so that it was appropriate for the age group. Now, a three-year-old's going to love this because they'll see the dancing and the music and the comedy and the fun and the brightness. 5 through 8 will get the learning segments. Adults will love the comedy and, again, the music. It has 8 musical numbers in it. Great musicians. Corey's cutting me off to say something
important. Well, just that you had said teach, and we are teaching, but actually I feel that the show is actually more about inspiring. It's not the kind of thing where it's going to be in-their-face education. It's more inspiration. Right.
Well, that's what I'm asking, I guess, and I'm not sure how to ask the question, because there are certain things you want to get in because it has to relate to the educational experience. There are certain things that you do exceedingly well because you're a lifelong entertainer and a magician and a puppeteer, et cetera, a clown. There are things that you want to accomplish because you, as a director, you want to make sure that it's not boring. It's entertaining.
It's very entertaining, which is kind of funny. This is when I was a kid, somebody said to me, and you probably remember the show, Get Smart with Don Adams. And the first time they said, you have to watch that show. And I'm thinking to myself as a little six-year-old, no, that sounds like such a dry talk show or game show. Or
Get Smart.
At the situation
comedy. Would you believe?
Yes, yes, yes.
If she's talking about the title was Get Smart.
Get Smart. So then I saw the show and I went, wow, this was the best comedy. So that's what Fun with STEM people don't really understand. We have Bo Broadwell, who was the choreographer, and he's phenomenal. He does Disney World Resort. And he said the other day, he said, you know what's really weird? This is out of the box. Nobody understands what it's going to be until they actually go see it.
Right.
It is funny. 8 musical numbers. It's a musical with comedy.
How hard was it to achieve? Because I guess that's
I'm still achieving it.
Still going.
Because you're synthesizing a lot of stuff and making it all into one special product.
Right. Mm-hmm. And it's also, you know, very small budget, and so, you know, that makes it obvious, always makes it harder, but the passion is so behind it, and the people that seem to be involved nowadays, like CMS and the it just seems like it's just needed to come together, and it's a very important thing for the children.
I assume that you have seen the script or have been to rehearsals for this?
I have not been to rehearsals, but we've seen the script. We've talked about it. Actually, my staff and I were going next week to one of the shows. We've been part. We've seen bits and pieces of it. And like I said, we wouldn't put the burden on this show to actually do the teaching, but it is just the natural curiosity of young children when it comes to the world around them. And if anybody's been around, you know, a child of that age, I think the two questions they ask are why and how. And this helps. And like I said, ask this program to be able to just bring out that curiosity, make the kids excited about it. And it's almost like you see the cooking shows in which they're hiding the vegetables in the spaghetti sauce. So it's almost like we're hiding the learning inside this beautiful musical program.
So when you bring students to this, and if it succeeds, and we're going to assume that it will, and it inspires them, then they have to go back to school, and Corey the Clown is not going to be there. The green screen is not going to be there. There's not going to be any music. There's going to be no singing and dancing, no puppets, no robots.
Jeez.
Well, our classrooms are quite not quite like that. We have, and like I said, this is for our very young children, and we have fabulous elementary school teachers out there that are bringing fun learning every single day. We work closely with other organizations. Discovery Education, our Parks and Rec, do wonderful programs for our schools. So like the learning continues. We have a program in our schools called Engineering is Elementary, in which they're solving problems and building things that go along with this curriculum. So it continues. It's not like we just totally cut them off.
And I know that you did actual research.
Yes, we did.
Very good.
And you discovered that Corey the Clown appeals to both boys and girls. Girls have tended in the past, at least, to stay away from science, technology, engineering, and math. This might help to draw them in?
Actually, the character in our show that is the scientist in our show is a female, a young female. You know, and she's a great actress. And just to inspire, just to show girls that, hey, we can all do this.
I have 15 seconds. If this is successful, and it's almost sold out, so it's going to be successful. What happens to it next?
It's around sale at carolinatix.org right now.
We'll get to that. What happens to it next?
Well, it is our hope. The North Carolina Science Festival, they are... I'll try and make it quick. They are talking about us touring the country with it, and we have talks in New York. So we are going to grow. We hope to do this every year.
That's Linda Ann Watt, producer, director of Fun with STEM. Corey Rybak is Corey the Clown in the show. Nancy Addison is with CMS. Fun with STEM's at the Booth Playhouse through April 6th, carolinatix.org or blumenthalarts.org for tickets.